Introverted noise.
Hurry up, Daddy.
All right. We are back. Welcome to another episode of the Pocket Protectors Podcast. I am your host, Jason Brown. You can find me on Twitter at BrownJason. And I'm here with everybody in, I guess, different locations. We got, you know, our man, Dr. Eric, getting settled in on the Eastern Standard Time. And Luke making his way slowly closer to Eric and myself. Repping from the heartlands. Doctor, how are you? How you doing? What's going on? How are things?
Things are good, man. You know, tomorrow we get to watch at least like preseason football, so that's pretty exciting. The next great quarterback in the NFL, Lamar Jackson, will be on display, so can't complain much, man.
That's very exciting. And apparently Flacco's having his best camp ever. It's very exciting
stuff.
So he's
having a medium camp?
Medium camp. He's on his way back
of his life?
Almost elite status for Joe Flacco because, you know, why don't they just trade him? Anyway, I'll get derailed on that one. Just get rid of Joe Flacco. Somebody will give him something for Joe Flacco. He won a Super Bowl. The Dolphins will probably give him a first round pick or something. No, John Gruden loves Derek Carr. He loves him. Have you seen that QB camp episode? He loves Derek Carr. But Luke, man, how you doing? You're all over my timeline, giving me play-by-play coverage of what's going on at, what is it, TCO Performing Arts Center or wherever?
The Performing Arts School at CTE. At CTE University. TCO Performance Center.
Yeah, man, how's it going? So like how long are you going to be giving us all this coverage, man? Because it's awesome. Keep it up.
I did 3 days. I got 5 more practices and then I got to get back to my day job. But yeah, I'll be there tomorrow, which is Thursday, probably the day you're listening to this, and then all the way through the night practice and a couple days after that.
Good stuff. And what are you doing with all this, like, I guess this information that you're pulling? I know you're live tweeting it. Are you pulling things together? You putting out articles or what are you doing with all this information you're gathering?
Yeah, I'm doing an article for every day that I'm there, which is a little bit more, you know, kind of classic journalism stuff, getting quotes, getting stories, much more classically formatted than what I usually write. And then in the afternoon, I'm live tweeting practice and just trying to give people a sense of who's standing out, who has good plays, who's getting beat on plays.
Nice.
As much info as I can.
And as always, you can find all of Luke's fantastic work over at Purple PTSD. Make sure you're going and checking it out. And are you getting any of these quotes? Like, are you recording anything? Anything going in the podcast? Anything going on like YouTube? Or is it just everything going onto the site in written form?
Shoot, I could upload all the interviews. I got them recorded, but I don't think I'll do that. I'm still doing the Purple Journal. We just actually recorded about an hour before we started recording this one. And we're probably going to be weekly on that one, uploading every Thursday now through the season. And then I don't know, maybe I'll do a show with someone else there or something, see what shakes out as the week goes on.
Good stuff. Well, all right, gentlemen, we got some questions. We got some things we need to run through here to talk about a little bit. And, this one came to me from the timeline. And it actually was born out of, I guess, some fantasy football kind of talk, not fantasy meeting with like real football. And somebody put out a tweet basically saying, can you find another 3-13 team that upgraded at quarterback? These Vikings are absolutely loaded on both sides of the ball. Strongest roster in football. Minnesota is my number one team heading into the season. And that was from Frank Schaub at Yahoo. The tweet will be in the notes. So if you want to click on it, check it out. And somebody responded, Michael David Smith, saying, did the Vikings actually upgrade at quarterback, though? Last year, Case Keenum was the number one quarterback in the NFL by DVOA, number three by QBR, number seven by passer rating, which begs the question, and that's the question I have for you gentlemen today. What is the likelihood that Kirk Cousins 2018 will be statistically better than Keenum's 2017? Eric, I will send that one to you first. Luke, feel free to hop in whenever you like.
Yeah, so that's a really good question. We have, you know, when we talk about things like war, what we're doing is like taking like when Keenum throws a pass into coverage and you know contested and Diggs snags it from the defensive back, you know, DVOA, you know, QBR, traditional passing stats are going to take something like that and they're going to give the full allotment to the compensatory allotment to the quarterback on a similar throw, right? And whereas we are sort of taking that and contextualizing it. So among quarterbacks who played, you know, fairly well last year, Case Keenum was not like in terms of war, you know, that highly regarded. He has a 2.7 or something like that, which is pretty good. I think especially from somebody who, if we're going to talk about training camp and overreacting, you know, people said was losing the backup job, Taylor Heineke at this time last year. So like, that's pretty good. We had Cousins last year at about a 0.9 war, which again, like, you know, a lot of things around him were sort of, you know, difficult with offensive line, receivers leaving, receivers getting hurt, running backs getting hurt. In 2016, we had Cousins more like about a 3.5 win guy. And in 2015, we had about a 2.5 win guy. So if you're just looking at that empirically, Case Keenum at sort of his peak, we think, Cousins probably, you know, of his 3 years as a starter eclipsed that once. So, you know, I think that the issue is when we look at there are 13-3 Minnesota Vikings, we look at Case Keenum versus Kirk Cousins. I don't think it's that difficult to make the argument that Cousins is better than Keenum's median or mean. But what the Vikings fans have to remember is that they didn't get Keenum's mean last year. They got like his upper bound. And the question then is Cousins average the same as Keenum's upper bound? I think that's a little less. I would say I'd put it probably at, you know, anywhere from, you know, 25 to 40% that he can eclipse that. And so, you know, obviously the Vikings got better in other situations. They got better at three technique. They got better, I think, sort of like team stability and sort of drafting Hughes in the first round. They're going to struggle on the offensive line. I think we're seeing that in camp and everything. But so I think the Vikings as a whole might have gotten better in the offseason, but there's a lot that they have to go against when they compare themselves to the 13-3 2017 team, namely that their quarterback played his career year.
Yeah, and I think that conversation, because it kind of was born out of like a fantasy world, is about volume stats. And you know, and you look at Case Keenum's like volume stats and say, okay, will Cousins get over 3,800? And everybody goes, oh, well, he got 4,000-yard season. So yeah, obviously. But I don't think we want that, because a 4,000-yard season for Cousins probably means that we're playing from behind a lot, and that's bad. And then I think, yeah, it's just important for Vikings fans to realize that there's not a very high chance that Case Keenum does this year what he did last year. And no matter how you measure it, he just probably won't be as good. That was definitely an anomaly for him, and all of our other priors tell us that that's not going to be the new normal. So, and the Vikings agree with that take. They bet on that by not offering Keenum a contract and letting him go to Denver. So in terms of the options available, if you were just choosing between Keenum and Cousins, I think all the priors of both of those quarterbacks tell you that Cousins is probably easily the choice. But yeah, Keenum's 2017 was awesome. And it's also hard to, I mean, I think we have this whole like expectation that the team has to improve over whatever they did last year, but there's not a lot of room to grow past 13-3. Like, you're pretty much just asking to get lucky a bunch, and that's not really a productive way to set expectations going into the season.
Well, and the other thing is that regular season record is not necessarily indicative of postseason success. So the classic example, I mean, we've seen examples of this all over the place. The 2007 New York Giants were, you know, I think not 10-6 maybe. And then in 2008, they were 13-3. And then they don't make win the Super Bowl. The Green Bay Packers in 2010 were 10-6, snuck into the playoffs, won the Super Bowl. In 2011, they were 15-1, got bounced. I think the Giants in 2011 were 9-7. In 2012, they were 10-6 and didn't even make the playoffs. So, like, even, you know, even if the Vikings don't finish 13-3, they might finish something like 10-6, 11-5. They still might be in contention. You know, I think one of the things that, and we were talking about this at the office today, and I think it's a great discussion, there are going to be situations, I can think of two of them, and both in the AFC South, where things might improve, but the outcomes might not. So, for example, I think the Tennessee Titans will improve as a team this year because of, you know, they have a better coaching staff, in my opinion. I think Mariota will play better, and I think that they'll just be more efficient. But they were 9-7 last year on the back of a lot of luck. They got to play, you know, pun intended, they got to play the Colts without luck twice. They got to play Jacksonville one game when they were, like, you know, tanking basically at the end of the year. And so, like, they're a team that's like 9-7 on paper, but I think last season we much more like a 6-10, 7-9 team. So if they improved to 8-8 on paper, that's still not going to look better. But I think as a process, that's fine. And the other one is Deshaun Watson. I think Deshaun Watson, you know, I think his stats were terrific last year, but there's a lot of things that were dependent upon other people. There are a lot of things that I think were sort of like schemed into his situation as a rookie quarterback. And so I think he'll improve this year, but I think his outcomes probably won't, just because that's such a high variance to achieve. And I think that the Vikings fans have to consider that. Like, you might be overall, your team might be better off and might have a better outlook for the future, and you still might see the team only go 10-6 or 11-5, and that's okay, right? Your schedule's tougher. You know, you're breaking in a new quarterback. There are a lot of growing pains there. There are a lot of things in the process that I think are good and could, you know, make the team better, but you might just not see 13-3, and that's fine.
Yeah. And so, and you bring up a good point there, because I know that we get, obviously, I mean, the game's about wins and losses, and that's the thing that fans are generally going to be really fixated on, is this is where we were last year, this is where we are this year, and just really looking at that as kind of the indication of whether we were better or worse. I guess from your perspectives, what might be some other things that fans should be looking at outside of just wins and losses to really determine if the team is better, you know, next year than they were last year?
I think there's a lot of, like, good tools out there, like PFF ELO, that can kind of give you a better sense of how good teams are, like, in the aggregate. And I think also just looking at, like, certain situations, like just looking at the overall win-loss record boils away a lot of strength of competition stuff, and looking, like, how they did in those situations. I think just the chances you're giving them, if the Vikings do get to the playoffs, like, how are they looking going into the playoffs? Where, like, I remember, you know, the 2015 Vikings were 11-5, and you'd think most 11-5 teams have a pretty good chance. But we went into those playoffs going, yeah, Carolina and Arizona, you know, those teams are probably going to be the teams, and we'll get, you know, if we get by Seattle, we'll probably lose to them. And then we didn't get by Seattle, but that probably wouldn't have mattered, because Carolina and Arizona were, you know, were on fire. So, I think, like, the difference between that, like, the difference between the 2015 Vikings and the 2017 Vikings was probably more than two wins. And, you know, going into the playoffs, you could have a 10-6 team that has a better chance because they're just better, but maybe they were in a tough division, or maybe someone was hurt and they lost a couple games because of it. You know, just applying that context and creating an evaluation with better tools can give you a much better sense of, like, who is actually a good team and therefore who has better odds to win these playoff games.
Yeah, I would say that anything that comes down to process versus results, whether it's something simple like a Massey ranking, which literally just takes who you played against and how the scores of the game went out, or something that uses Pro Football Focus grades. I know Football Outsiders says DVOA. I think that 2015 Seahawks team was something like first in DVOA or something. So, you know, that didn't end up being very predictive, but, you know, anything like that, I think, gets you in the ballpark. I know strength of schedule is huge, and we sort of look at that when we do anything. And that can account for a lot of the differential. You know, for example, when we were trying to project the NFC South, we think Atlanta has by far the easiest path in that division. And so that's why we have them on parity with the Saints, even though I think the Saints on average are a little stronger. Like all of those things, you know, come into play. And, you know, last season, the Vikings kind of had a perfect storm because, you know, their division, you know, their best quarterback in the division was injured for most of two games they played. And, you know, they lost one game to the Lions, but the Bears were a little weaker, building in a rookie quarterback and having kind of a fossil as a coach. And then the AFC North was not strong at all. And so they got three sort of gimmies in that division. It's just going to be a little different this year, and it's okay. I mean, again, you know, if you're a Vikings fan, this team has been good probably your entire life. They just, you know, the goal should be to win the Super Bowl. And if it takes, you know, a record that you're not quite thrilled with, but a process that's like, I think you got to play the long game.
That makes sense. That makes sense here. And so, again, I think the word here is the team is going to be good, but don't freak out if they don't have the record that they had in previous years, because the schedule is a little bit tougher. There's other things working against them, but they're still likely to be pretty good. And if they get in the playoffs, they should have a chance. More stuff from the timeline, because, you know, we talked about Le'Veon Bell and whether or not he should get paid the last time we were recording. And then Todd Gurley went and he got all the money. He got all the money. He got all the money that Le'Veon Bell was hoping to get. And now it's looking like with Todd Gurley getting all this money that Le'Veon Bell is going to break the bank probably in the next offseason. So it got me thinking about a tweet that Marcus Mosier put out, where he basically compared the Patriots backfield and how they produced with their running back by committee versus what, you know, a Le'Veon Bell produced as an individual. And then comparing kind of how much the Patriots were paying their running backs versus, you know, what Le'Veon Bell was looking for, kind of making the point that why on earth would you pay one person all this when you can pay five guys less and get, you know, similar production? So my question, Eric, again, we'll start with you on this one here, is just who had the most valuable backfield when we look back at 2017? And, you know, how did those, I guess, those top running back by committee type backfield stack up when you look at them in comparison to the guys we'd consider the top running backs in the league, like Todd Gurley and Le'Veon Bell and those types of guys?
Yeah. So, I mean, we had one team last year that had a positive, and I think this sort of proves the point, that had a positive expected value in terms of running the football, and that was Dallas. And of course, like, Dallas spent a ton of draft capital on Ezekiel Elliott, but he wasn't actually available for, you know, a fair amount of that season. Alfred Morris, we had him. He was actually a little bit above replacement level, but he averaged, you know, a good, you know, set, you know, 4.5, almost 5 yards to carry last year. Now with Ezekiel Elliott, you know, he's a guy, again, kind of in that like less than a win area. We had actually the second best team running the football last season was New Orleans. We had their runners as the most valuable let me look here, Mark Ingram about half a win and Alvin Kamara about 1.9 wins. So that in the aggregate was the highest. To speak to Marcus's point, Deion Lewis, Rex Burkhead, Mike Gillisley, James White all added to about 2 wins a season ago. So they were very valuable. Todd Gurley was in the 1.7 range and Le'Veon Bell is in the 1.2 range. So we like, you know, pass receiving is sort of our biggest thing. And, you know, for us, that's what we're going to, you know, sort of weigh heavily in our war models. Bell is a good pass receiver, but he had some drops a season ago. And then he was basically league average running the ball, 4.0 yards per carry. So, you know, it's going to be one of those things where it's going to be difficult for me to really look at, somebody like, Le'Veon Bell and say, hey, let's give him all the monies, because I just don't see, I just don't see how somebody who's going to command the ball, who's going to command what I would view as kind of like negative game script over the course of a long season. I don't necessarily know if that's what I want to buy into. Whereas the Patriots running backs, I sort of like think have, you know, the analogy is sort of like low self-esteem. they like what they can get, and they don't complain much. And on average, they add to a pretty good backfield in and of themselves.
Yeah, Luke, and I know that you've had I know that you've had some takes, some thoughts in terms of, you know, yeah, the Rams, who are one of the teams that, you know, are people often think about when they are thinking about the elite teams in the NFC. The Rams are in there with the Vikings in that conversation. I guess, what were your thoughts when, you know, the Rams went and spent all that money on a running back?
Here's my worry if I'm a Rams fan, and I live in LA, so I'm like kind of a low-key Rams fan. If that contract prohibits them from hanging on to Aaron Donald, they made a massive mistake. And I think most people would understand that, like, Aaron Donald means more to the Rams than Todd Gurley does, just because of how replaceable what Todd Gurley does is. But, like, in terms of Le'Veon Bell, like, a run to Le'Veon Bell is a pretty bad play by EPA and by Warren. It just, the more you run to Le'Veon Bell, the more 2 and 3 yard gains you're going to have, and that's just not going to be enough to keep yourself ahead of the chains. Todd Gurley, I think, had himself a pretty good season last season. And I think, and I remember, and this might go to a conversation we'll have later, but I remember when you were talking about just run versus pass in general, that the 2016 Rams were so bad at the pass. It was like one of the only outlier times where a run to Gurley was better than a golf pass in 2016. I think if he can be a good passing weapon and those plays can be successful and keep you ahead of the chains and keep things moving and then even create explosive plays every once in a while, then he's going to be as good as any pass catching threat, right? Just a matter of whether or not the yards come before or after the catch. And ultimately you don't care. But I think if you're going to come in with this like pound the rock mentality, now that you've paid your running back, what, $15 million average a year, and then you're going to come in and like run him too much because you feel like you've committed to it, then I think you're just bamboozling yourself.
Oh yeah, random question. Random question, just because, you know, Luke reminded me of it. What does like Todd Gurley's WAR look like versus, like, I guess, the Stephon Diggs? I know that you guys referenced some stuff like that in that NFC North preview.
Yeah, so Stephon Diggs was the most valuable non-quarterback in the division over the last 3 years. So you're talking about Diggs a season ago was about 1.27 WAR. In 2016, he was 0.99. In 2015, let me pull this up, a little bit less than that. But in aggregate, you're talking about pretty consistent play, whereas Gurley is in the 1.7s. And then in 2016, he's in the 0.2. And then I believe his rookie year, 2015, he's about a half. Right. So running back sort of bouncing up and down. Gurley, of course, became valuable when he started taking those screen passes. But again, that's kind of more dependent upon scheme, right? And getting him those types of opportunities. And that's why I think, again, somebody like Diggs is going to be more valuable on the aggregate than Gurley, because if offensive line play doesn't pan out, I think Gurley averaged something like, I think Gurley had something like 87 yards before contact in 2016, right? So what the heck is the guy supposed to do? But then when things open up for him, that's great. Just like I've said with Cousins before, if I'm going to pay somebody top market rate, I'm going to need that player to be impervious to quite a bit. And, you know, quarterbacks are more able to be impervious. We've seen somebody like Diggs has played well with Bridgewater. He's played well with Sean Hill that one start. He's played well with Bradford. He's played well with Keenum. Like, that player is a player I want to buy into. Cousins, yeah, you guys all know how I feel about Cousins, but it's a little bit more dependent upon the players around him. And so that's the thing with Gurley. It's like, you can get this top level performance from him, but you can also get somebody who's barely above replacement level because, you know, the situation beckons. It's the same thing with guys like Elliott. Last year, the Cowboys game script was not inducive to him being as good, as valuable as the season before. You know, but that receivers, quarterbacks, as Luke said, you know, guys that rush the passer, coverage players, less dependent upon that. I like the only angle to this that I think could make it defensible is if the Rams are prepared not to extend Jared Goff if he doesn't end up being elite. if he ends up in that sort of like Dalton, Flacco, Cousins, frankly, range, then, and the Rams say, okay, we know we have a good team and we know we have a great coach and we know we can scheme the guy up, and they just draft another guy high again. That's like, I think what makes this make sense. But with Goff and with Donald's contracts, Marcus Peters sort of on the board, you know, coming up here, it makes less sense to me.
I think there's a misconception with running backs too, especially like Gurley, where you go, well, he's going to touch the ball so much more than any of your receivers are, you know. People said that about Elliott a lot and about Le'Veon Bell a lot. Well, you know, well, pay him because he accounts for, you know, a third of your whole team's touches. And that's kind of like a participation trophy, isn't it? Like a run to Bell or a run to Gurley is just not going to gain you as many yards. It's not going to bring you as much progress as, say, a target to Brandon Cooks. So you're going to be incentivized to throw to Brandon Cooks more than you are to run to Todd Gurley, because theoretically a Todd Gurley run is not as good as a Brandon Cooks target. So I think even though you maybe will do the suboptimal thing twice as much, because I don't know, we're figuring that out. But if you're going to do the suboptimal thing more, the fact that it's suboptimal should be a lot more important than how often you plan to do it. You shouldn't pay someone for participation. You should pay them for being valuable.
Perfect. Perfect. And doing the suboptimal thing more often is a wonderful segue to a conversation that was had on the Twitter.com, where I feel like somewhere along the way we lost the plot of what it was we were actually talking about. But Eric did bring a lot of really, really, really good information to bear that I did want to revisit it. So I guess the initial question, as I understand it, was if a team is just terrible at throwing the ball, should they run more? And will running more give that team a better chance to win than relying on their terrible quarterback? I guess if you want to put some put this more in perspective, think the Vikings through basically all of Adrian Peterson's career that wasn't 2009. And did it make sense for them to run the offense through Adrian Peterson because he was so good and all of our quarterbacks were so bad? Eric, what say you?
So first off, I'm going to extend the olive branch to Flip. Like Flip, want, you know, glad that he engages in this stuff. For me, you know, the question is great, right? So you just asked, should the Vikings run the offense through Adrian Peterson? And I always sort of back, like, you know, 10 years ago, I used to ask this question to Packer fan friends. I said, like, do you guys want Adrian Peterson? Because I feel like he would just slow your offense down, you know, whereas, and I, back then I didn't have the analytics with me. So but I felt like I was getting close to the answer. Now there's two different parts of this question. The first one is, should you build a team where this is your strength? And the answer to that is unequivocally no. I posted a, you know, sort of like a graph I made really quickly, but basically the idea is that every single team in the NFL is a negative expected points team running the football, except for random teams every once in a while. Last year, there happened to be one team that was positive. That was Dallas. In 2016, I think there were two, maybe the Jets and the Bills. Neither team made the playoffs. Dallas didn't make the playoffs last year. I think it's the Jets. I'll have to go back and look. But it's not, you know, so running the football is never a positive thing, except for very rare circumstances. Whereas, you know, half the league on a given year, oftentimes two-thirds of the league, is generating positive expected points every time they drop back the pass on average. So, like, you should never build your team that way. But the next question is, given your team is built this way, should you run the ball more? Like, should you, and as I think Flip said, play to your strengths? And I think that that's a really interesting question because, you know, there, we did know that, you know, 2012 was one example where the Vikings averaged more expected points running the ball than did throwing. So in that particular case, I think you can make the case that running the ball is a better play than passing. However, when you look at situations where teams are, you know, like second and long, even first and 10, like those things shrink even more. Running the ball on those long yardage situations is a sucker play. And so even teams like I looked at, you know, the 2016 Houston Texans, I looked at for a different question. And even though Brock Osweiler was one of the worst quarterbacks in the NFL, they were still more efficient running the ball or throwing the ball than running the ball on long yardage situations in that season. They were just bad at both. They were less bad at passing than they were at running. So, you know, I think, yeah, it's one of those things that I brought up a few, you know, examples from, you know, psychology, basically this idea that people are risk averse and people do what's comfortable. So the classic example is, you know, when, you know, health insurance, people will take basically high premium, low deductible insurance over, you know, the alternative, because it feels good to like know that if, you know, you need it, you don't have to pay out that much, even though if you do the calculation, the actual high deductible, low premium is actually a better expected value. People will almost, you know, almost always go for the former situation because it like sort of feels more safe. I think that running the football is very much along that path where people are like, well, I'm playing to my strength and we don't have a good passer. But if they actually did the math, I think in most cases, even bad passers are better at throwing the ball in long yardage situations than their team is at running it. And I think the last kicker, we talked about this last night on Twitter with Hermsmeyer and other people, quarterbacks that aren't very good are probably going to be more efficient on first and second down than they are going to be on third down, because other teams know they're passing on third down. There's some level of deception on first and second down. So if you have a quarterback who isn't very good, that's where you can kind of elevate his game.
I think it's important to kind of, when you're deciding, okay, am I going to be run first or pass first, or will I, you know, will I prefer to run or pass? Remember that this is what you do, not what you do relative to the rest of the league. You know, relative to the rest of the league is a great way to evaluate teams and like predict outcomes and stuff. But if you're a decision maker, you know, maybe I'm worse at passing than the rest of the league and I'm better at running than the rest of the league. But that can be true. And also passing still gets you more production and gets you closer to first downs and makes you, you know, makes it easier for you to move the chains. So, you know, if a bad passing play is still better than a good running play, then I'm going to take a passing play that's just not as good as everyone else's passing play, because at least that gets me, you know, that gets me closer to moving the chains. And if you are a team with a crappy passing game that's contending, you probably are doing so because of a crazy defense, you know, a good defensive effort, or a corner case scenario like 2012 Adrian Peterson. So honestly, playing to your strengths, like if you just look at, you know, my running versus my passing and forget the rest of the league, and not I'm 28th in this and second in that, but just running gets me this much and passing gets me this much, or a way a coach will actually look at it is, you know, running out of this set, this play, this zone run from the blah, blah, blah gets me this much versus passing out of this set gets me this much. And if passing is always higher, then pass. And if you are one of those rare teams where running gets you more EPA than passing, then yeah, run. But that's going to be a corner case scenario. And building that for a corner case scenario is a fool's errand.
A fool's errand. I like it. So the other part of that, I guess, was one of the things that Flip brought up that I thought was also interesting is that, so you're a coach. Obviously, we know what the numbers say, but sometimes, not sometimes, a lot of the times, the numbers don't strike the emotional chord that you need when you're dealing with kind of the realities of, you know, people. And so if you have, say, Christian Ponder as your quarterback, but Adrian Peterson is your running back, maybe your locker room's like, why on earth are we letting Christian Ponder throw? Why don't we give it to Adrian Peterson? Like, we're losing. Why wouldn't we be losing with our best players being the featured players? How do you navigate a situation like that where the numbers, like you said, people are generally speaking going to kind of, they're going to be drawn towards a thing that feels safe, and, you know, passing and failing, I guess, for whatever reason, it feels riskier than, you know, getting that 2 yard or 3 yards, maybe on first down when you run the ball. How do you balance those things out when what you're asking people to do might be that thing that doesn't feel as safe as what they're accustomed to?
I mean, I think this is the issue, right? Like, this is why we've made not as good of progress as we should have in this space. The issue is communication. I mean, ultimately, like I thought, you know, Mackie and Judd, which I think is a great radio show, they had Gabe Kapler, who at the time I think was an analyst. He had a blog, and now he's the manager of the Phillies. Basically, you know, talked about when Joe Maddon was his coach in Tampa Bay. You know, one of the analytics guys came downstairs, and he's like, you know, how do we, you know, Gabe, you know, you really like, what's your favorite pitch? And he was like, well, I like high fastballs. And like, well, let's look at this chart, and like, this is how well you do swinging at high fastballs. And he's like, that was the first time somebody ever told me something with numbers that, you know, made me change the way that I play the game. And I think, like, you know, whether it's, and again, we, you know, at PFF, we talk to coaches and players, and we talk to, you know, former coaches, former players. And like, the issue, I think, is partly on us, man. I mean, we have to, you know, talk to people and say, you know, what is it about running the ball that you think is beneficial? And actually, some of their reasoning, I think, is fairly sound. I think, you know, quarterbacks, for example, need a mental break, you know, every once in a while. So far be it for me to say you should throw every down, right? I think that's a plausible reason to run the football. So then if you're trying to be analytically sound, then have the guy run the ball when it's advantageous, or at least closer to advantageous, right? So you can't get a positive expected value all the time in life, but you can mitigate your issues, right? So run the ball in short yardage, second and three, second and two, third and one, you know, like, you obviously do have to live within the confines of the players that, you know, and the people, the humans that you deal with when you do analytics and you do numbers. But you can do a good job of bridging the gap, I think, communication, and then also just sticking to the principles. Like, you know, how the players feel does not negate the math, but you can sort of make the two, I think, work out in a better way.
Yeah, I like that. I like that. I like that. So on the communication front, because I know this is obviously something that you know, you deal with, you battle with, on a fairly consistent basis from a PFF perspective, what are some of the things you think we can do? Just, you know, maybe this podcast, or just generally speaking, as folks who lean on the analytics side of things to get people maybe thinking about things differently, or thinking about things in a way that aligns with what the numbers say is a more optimal way of doing things. Luke?
Yeah, I think for one, putting it in context of the way that like coaches and decision makers think about it, and then just making things accessible. I think sometimes that, you know, stats guys will post these like super complex looking charts from scientific papers that are really informative and really right and really well thought out and researched, but they're like Greek to the average football viewer, and you're never going to get any progress made if you're not going to try to appeal to your audience. But also, you know, I think sometimes we like oversimplify things into just running period versus passing period, and no coach looks at it that way. They look at their concepts and, you know, which run plays are we going to call out of which sets? And this is something that Doug Peterson is really good at, is, you know, taking one look and running a play, and then taking another look and then running a play out of that, or folding both of those plays into a run pass option and having the quarterback decide which to do post snap. So, you know, putting it into the context that like is real life applicable, I think gives you a much better chance of getting it, you know, of being heard. I think what Josh Hirschmeier is doing right now with his whole men in box study is amazing, because, you know, ultimately there's situations where you just shouldn't run, right? You shouldn't run on second and 10 because a 4-yard gain, which is most coaches would consider a good run play, isn't enough, right? Third and 6 isn't a very good situation. You want to shoot a little higher than that. And running the ball against 9 men in the box is obviously stupid. They have an extra guy. Coaches understand, hey, don't run when there's going to be an unblocked guy ready to blow up your run play.
Do they?
Say what?
Do they? I feel like our coaches don't always know that. Matt Asiata says our coaches don't know that.
Yeah, maybe not the Tennessee Titans. But, you know, if you go to a coach and you say, hey, they have an unblocked guy, maybe don't run into that. That's going to be a much easier sell than, well, you know, on second down situations, the average distribution of blah, it's just not accessible information, even though it's as thorough. So I think changing the way we package it and market it can, you know, bring a new era of growth into the analytics world in football.
Yeah, and I think the barrier here is that oftentimes folks, when they do, and you know, when they do mathematical work or scientific work, one of the issues is that in the scientific community, you have to show that what you're doing has depth and is difficult. And yet at the same time, like, it's not going to have any applicability if it's not translatable. And so, like, we just simply don't train quantitative people very well at communication, because we train them to try to, like, do the most impressive, most difficult work in that space. So that's what I think where the difficulties are.
All right. What you're saying is we need to get some graphic designers in there with the numbers people, so we can get some stuff out there for the folks that to be able to see and love and understand. And I guess it seems like you guys are on the right track. And this last piece here, sorry, listeners, it's going to be a bit blatant, but you know, Eric and his folks, they do really, really, really great work. I'm a big fan. Luke is a big fan. You should all also be big fans. But Eric, he's been doing even more great work, digging in even deeper, going into the realm of college analytics, doing some new stuff there. And then PFF has launched Premium Stats 2.0. And so to kind of bring things home here, just wanted Eric to talk a little bit about what's going to be going on as, college football is right around the corner, to get an understanding of what PFF is going to be doing in the college space, utilizing Dr. Eager's big brains here, and then what they're going to be doing with these Premium Stats 2.0 that we should all be really excited about. So, Eric, the infomercial is all yours.
Yeah, so what's really cool is that last year we had, I think, a good amount of success building metrics and things like that for NFL. We've always kind of been an information site. And I think that, you know, starting last year, we started to do a good job of using it to contextualize our information and be predictive. So this offseason, I was training, basically a part-timer for us in building a college version of PFF ELO. And then, like, and there will be weekly sort of a spread pick column using that model plus a few other things. So somewhat self-serving. I think I wanted to dig into to our college data now that we're starting our fifth year of collecting college data. But I also wanted to give, my colleague and friend Ben Brown has kind of been really, he's probably going to be producing the majority of that content this year. And so, so hopefully, you guys will enjoy his stuff, but it's also kind of for me to look at our college data and poke and prod at it. So then when it comes time to start to give some of our team clients and also you guys, the consumers, college to pro content will be sharp there. And as far as Premium Stats 2.0, I think that there's a lot of cool context there. You can look at, multiple seasons, look at how guys grade over seasonal chunks. I think that the interface is much easier to work with. Premium Stats were our main product at first. We took them away for a while and now they're back. So hopefully you guys will like that. And some of the information that we're able to give the teams and give to you guys and sort of look at, kind of find your own little nooks and crannies in our data.
Very excited. Very, very excited about all the productivity that will be lost with me digging into PFF stats to answer silly questions that get posed on Twitter. Usually it's something from Twitter, whereas someone says something, it's like, I wonder what that is. Let me go spend the next hour and a half digging into PFF to see if I can find the answer for that to share with absolutely no one but myself. So looking forward to it. And before we get out of here, I know that the latest episode of The Forecast is up. The link to that will be in the show notes. Eric, is there anything else from you, George, or anyone else at PFF that you'd like to plug before we get you out of here?
So, one of the things that I don't think people know is that George Shahuri, my colleague, this season will be his first, I think, you know, as part of the production of Sunday Night Football. So starting tomorrow. So I'm, you know, just ecstatic to see, you know, his growth and that kind of thing. And I think the PFF stuff, whether that be like win probability stuff or our stats, will be a much bigger part of that product. So, I mean, that's, I think, next level stuff. And it's just been a joy to work with George. So that's I'm proud to see that. We have obviously the PFF forecast is, you know, we talk about the AFC West, where my other favorite team resides. So that was cool this week. And then, yeah, tomorrow we'll be talking about some division projections on the YouTube. So myself and Steve Palazzolo will be doing that. So exciting times, looking forward to the game tomorrow and being able to produce, like you said, the college content coming up soon.
Awesome. And Luke, I know we talked about it a little bit, but what do you have coming up? And obviously we can find it at Purple PTSD, but of all the things you produced of late, what is your absolute favorite, the one that we should read first?
The one that I would love for people to read is one that I posted yesterday on Purple PTSD titled What It's Like to Be Undrafted. I talked to a bunch of the undrafted rookies in camp and just got kind of a sense of their experience. Most of these guys are coming off the craziest year of their lives. And, you know, traveling around the country and just the stresses you just can't imagine. So go check that out. But I think the one that everybody's going to want to read is about Stephon Diggs being a locker room leader and just the impact that he has on the culture of the Vikings, which I think, you know, we're all very familiar with the impact he has on the field, but his impact off of it on the team is also worth thinking about. And I'm going to keep writing. I'm going to put something up just about every day that I'm in town. And then we'll be podcasting all the way through the season.
This is very confusing, though. I mean, all these quotes that are coming out about Stephon Diggs, gym rat, leader.
Wide receiver one.
Very strange stuff. I don't understand it at all. I'm not sure if they've ever seen Stephon Diggs. These things are they're all wrong. All very, very wrong. But anywho, gentlemen, as always, it is a pleasure. Thank you for coming on and helping me get smarter about the foosball. And listeners, I hope you enjoyed the episode. If you have any feedback for us, obviously, hit us up on Twitter. Let us know. And yeah, that's all we got for tonight. As always, my name is Jason Brown. I am your host. Find me on Twitter at BrownJason, joined by the good doctor and Luke reporting from training camp. And yeah, we will talk to you soon. Have a good one.